Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren. Co-host is David North Martino.
My real name again.
Yeah, I know. That's crazy. In a row. And just, well, you know, I mean, after that last week, I was getting too much mail about being mean. I was being mean again. I was on the upswing of, you know.
And, well, I'll answer to anything. Just about. Maybe.
<That's>, no, I just, yeah. So I thought I'd be polite for the week, and then they can, maybe they'll pick on you.
Maybe.
Maybe you'll say something.
I welcome it.
Yeah. So don't ask for it. You'll get it.
You know? I know.
People have nothing to do, you know. And I guess you're jumping off of Twitter right away. Hey, you're hiding now
because. Oh yeah, I'm hiding. Right.
Yeah, it's crazy, crazy. Mm-hmm. All that people just go wild with these stories. So
yeah.
Well. Okay. Yeah, I know. So let's see. Now we are talking about Marilyn Monroe today. Now, we're not talking about any of the conspiracies that we've had on before, those silly things. What we're going to do is talk about Marilyn on a realistic kind of life portrait sort of way. And we've got an incredible author from the UK that's written several books covering Marilyn and kind of different parts of her life. So a new book coming out, When Marilyn Met the Queen, Marilyn Monroe's Life in England. And that comes out, I believe it's next week on Tuesday, May 3rd. So the author's here, Michelle Morgan. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. This is a thrill. It'll be good to talk about Marilyn as more of a human being and kind of more realistic things than space aliens and lizard people and stuff. You know, it's just, you've written several books now. You've covered her a lot. What is the attraction for you to in-depthly cover Marilyn Monroe?
Well, I've been a fan since I was 15, which is way back in 1985. And I just always, you know, I loved her ever since then. And so when I first started writing, it seemed like a natural thing to write about Marilyn. And so I wrote my first book in 1995, which was like a little book called Marilyn's Addresses. And since then, it's just been, I've been very, very lucky that opportunities keep coming my way to write about her again. You know, I've done like a full biography of her, and then But different publishers have asked me to write different things, like about her modeling career or her life in New York in the 1950s and that kind of thing. So, I'm always very, very happy to write about Marilyn. She's such a joy to write about. And I just feel like, you know, how is this work? If somebody wants me to write about Marilyn, then, you know, I'm always looking at Marilyn pictures and reading about her anyway. So, you know, how can I say no? She's just a blessing.
Right. I see that. Now, when you do something like this, when you're doing the research and things like that, and you try to, you know, find people or that knew her or places, and you try to find out information, how do people act or react with you?
That's such a good question. So sometimes people are quite standoffish and they don't want to speak because they've spoken before and maybe their words have been taken out of context, or that, you know, they've had their fingers burnt in some other way. And I try and persuade them that, you know, that I'm a nice girl and that I won't, you know, I won't do anything awful, and they open up to me. And you know, some people do still say no. You know, I asked Arthur Miller, for instance, when he was alive, if he would be interviewed for one of the books, and he straight out was just like, you know, no, and that was it. But for the most part, I found that a lot of people are quite happy to talk about Marilyn. Sadly, you know, unfortunately, quite a few of the people that she knew or worked with have now left us. But I've been very privileged over the years to be able to speak to quite a few, and they were all lovely. You know, I came away from each call or each meeting thinking, you know, that I've found a new friend, and oftentimes I have, because they're just, you know, they've all been just lovely people. And to be honest, I haven't met, well, maybe one or two who've said, you know, negative things about her, but for the most part, people want to speak about the real Marilyn and who she really was and how happy she made them and, you know, what it was like to actually know her, which I think is really important.
Well, what do you think the biggest misconception or the biggest thing is that people in general public think they know about her that, you know, isn't true?
I think the main thing is that people think that she was a dumb blonde because of the roles that she played on the screen. And she actually addressed this during her life and said, you know, she didn't really understand it. And I don't understand it either, because, you know, she was an actress and she played these dumb blonde roles. Some of them weren't dumb blondes at all. But there's absolutely no reason for people to think that she was dumb as a person. You know, she had a huge book collection. She was never without her head in a book. She studied acting. She did all these different things that, you know, she was very brave. She was very strong and determined. And she was in no way, shape or form a dumb blonde. And if you speak to anybody who knew her, nobody has ever said to me she was so dumb. Nobody. Everyone is always very forthright in their observation that she was very, very smart.
So what brought her to the UK? What brought her to England?
Well, she came over here in 1956 to make a movie called The Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier. And she wanted to work with Laurence Olivier because he was the so-called greatest actor. And she thought that that would make people take her more seriously. He was quite keen to work with her because he was having trouble getting another film off the ground, and he thought that it would just be this sort of fluffy rom-com that he could just, you know, sort of do and then go get back to the more serious Shakespearean stuff. And so, yeah, that's why she came over here. Both of them thought that it would be a wonderful time. Unfortunately for them, it didn't work out that way. They didn't get along at all. And so, yeah, it's been really interesting to write about that, because both of their misconceptions, they had just had so many misconceptions of what was going to happen on the set every day, and it just didn't work out like that. So that's been really interesting to delve into.
What would be the problem? Was it is it because of the, you know, Olivier being more of a serious trained theatrical actor, and Marilyn being more, I guess, of a commercial success actress? Is it just sort of the difference of their approach to acting, or was it personal?
I think that it was both of those things. When Laurence Olivier was the director, and he introduced Marilyn to the rest of the cast and crew, most of which he had already worked with before. So they were all old friends, all working at Pinewood together or in the theatre together. And he basically introduced her and said, you know, that her technique wasn't the same as their technique. So they would have to be a bit patient, or, you know, what words to that effect. And she took that as being very condescending and patronising. And from that moment, she wondered, you know, what she was getting herself into. And you know, vice versa, he then wondered about her technique, because she was a method trained actress and she brought along all her entourage and the, you know, her drama coach and everybody else. And of course, then she was also not known to be on time. So she was quite often late on the set. Sometimes she didn't come at all. And all of those things just sort of worked everybody up. But within that story, there's so many layers to the story, because there's that story of them actually making the film. But then there's the other story as well of the press and the journalists and everyone else got so angry because they were kept away from the set by Laurence Olivier. So they spent a lot of time trying to break into the set and trying to create these different stories and find out all the different scandals and all that kind of thing. And then there's also the story of the whole of the UK just went completely Marilyn crazy in the summer of 1956. Everybody wanted her to come and open their garden fates or their supermarkets or whatever it was. And so there's, you know, there's so many layers to the story. But, you know, at the very heart of it is the fact that these two superstars just really, really hated each other by the end of the trip, and they couldn't wait to say goodbye.
Well, that's, you know, it happens, but it's funny. Did you have any problems finding out about their relationship from anybody? Were people kind of protective of what really went on behind the scenes?
I was really lucky. I mean, I've been researching this book for 30 years. This is the first book that I ever wanted to write. Now, I've now had like 25 books published. And this was the very, very first book I ever wanted to write. So back in 1992, I started to research and I started to interview people. And some of the people that I was in, that I was trying to interview then, they wouldn't speak to me at that point. I don't know whether they thought maybe it was still too close to, you know, to reality, or whether it was because I had never written a book or what, I don't know. But then over the years, I've been able to interview more and more people, and they were all, from then on, they were all very forthcoming about working with Marilyn and Laurence Olivier. And you know, I've interviewed a few people in the past couple of years who were just so glad to be able to revisit those days. And, you know, they would tell me these little stories that were very little to them, because it was things that they did on an everyday basis at the studio. And I was just going crazy, going, oh my God, that's the best story ever. And they must have thought that I was just, you know, bonkers. But they all really enjoyed going back to those times and talking about not just Marilyn, but, you know, what their life was like in Pinewood Studios and their working day and everything else. So it's been a huge blessing for me to speak to all of these people.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, you're talking about your first book coming out or writing it in 1992. What made you want to write?
Well, it's funny, because when I was a teenager, I always thought I wanted to be an actress. And I think that was mainly because Marilyn was an actress. And at that point, I was like, well, I want to be like Marilyn. And so I used to write these letters to producers and things and, you know, theatre companies and stuff. And every single one of them would write back to me and say, I don't know how you can act, but you sure can tell a good story, or you sure can write a good letter. And it suddenly occurred to me when I was about 20 that I'm not actually an actress, I'm a writer. Because they used to say to me, okay, come for an audition. And I'd be like, oh, no, I can't go for an audition. What are you talking about? And then it just suddenly just occurred to me, you know, my whole life I've written stories and imaginary articles and imaginary books and all these things I used to read. I still do read all the time. And so it was just suddenly like an awakening. And I remember going to my acting teacher and saying, oh, I'm not going to be an actress anymore, I'm going to be a writer. And she sort of poo-pooed it. And it gave me great pleasure to send her a copy of my book a couple of years later and say, well, you know, I am a published author now. But that's really how it happened. I just like just woke up.
Yeah, take that.
Yeah.
How was Marilyn in the UK, like before she arrived, first of all, was she popular there or was she not really a figure they knew about?
No, she was very, very popular. She was as popular over here as she was in America. And when it was first announced that she was coming over here, everybody was just so excited about it. The newspapers were sending journalists to the house that they thought that she was going to live in. Some of them like took pictures of her bedroom. One of them took a picture of him lying on the bed that they thought that she was going to be staying in. I mean, everyone was just, you know, really excited about her coming over here. So she was a huge star when she came, but I think she was even bigger by the time she left.
So was she received really well then when she arrived in London?
She was. A couple of days before she arrived, her representatives went to London Airport to talk about the security issues. And the stuffed shirts in the offices were like, oh, no, we don't go for that kind of thing here. We're just going to treat it like any other arrival. And then by the time she left New York, they had realized that it was going to be a huge thing when she came. And by the time her plane left, there was literally hundreds of people on the tarmac. There was people actually on the planes, looking over the wings of the planes and everything. Everyone just went crazy for her. So it was a huge deal when she came. And then after that, everybody used to crowd around her door or her driveway gate trying to see her. People were, going up the driveway, trying to get into the house. We had the students who came and serenaded her under her bedroom window in the middle of the night. Everybody wanted to see Marilyn. But the thing was that everybody who thought that she was going to spend a lot of time conversing with the journalists who were camped outside her driveway, they became disappointed. And so the mood sort of started to shift when the journalists realized that she wasn't going to be as open to them as she was with the public and, and that she was actually here to work. So the media for a time did sort of not sour towards her, but kind of made snippy little remarks about her. But certainly the people still loved her. And they, I've spoken to so many people who spent their summer holidays that year just standing at the gates of her house waiting for her to come out. And I just love that. I love that, those stories. And, everyone just seemed to love her.
Yeah, that's what I have to go through.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, they're always waiting at the gates of my house. Well,
with picket signs.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's for a different reason, but yeah. I wasn't going to mention that. But. Now, you mentioned how the press was a little snipey, or in the book part, you kind of meant to say they're hostile, actually. So was that the primary reason that they had that kind of hostile behavior toward her, or was it something more?
Yeah, I think it was because they couldn't have access to her. It definitely was. They were trying to get into the set, and Laurence Olivier was keeping them off the set, and they did get hostile towards, not towards him in a physical way, but in words. They just didn't like the fact that Marilyn was being kept away from people. And it was funny because they blamed Laurence Olivier for not being able to get to her at Pinewood. And then they blamed her husband, Arthur Miller, for not being able to get to her at Parkside House where they were living. And then if she turned down an event, they were like, oh, well, why is she doing that event, but she's not doing this event? And, they desperately wanted more press conferences. I mean, they had four press conferences in the first couple of days that she arrived here. And they basically just thought that it would go on like that for the whole trip. And when it didn't, they became a little bit disgruntled. And I remember I interviewed one. Well, I think of him as a young lad because he was back in the 50s, but he's not a young lad now. He was standing outside the gates and a journalist actually gave him a letter and said, I dare you to go over the fence and go and give this letter to Marilyn. They just all sorts of things like that. And then two other journalists got into the grounds and they scaled up to the top of the house and tried to dangle off the roof to try and see Marilyn in her bedroom. Just all things like this. They were very, very frustrated that she wouldn't give them the time that they wanted to have with her.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, you know, but that's the press, you know.
Yeah.
Awful people. Yeah. Well, so that's curious. So now, how did the Queen decide, or why did the Queen decide she was actually going to meet with Marilyn? Like, how did that whole thing happen?
Well, Marilyn really, really wanted to meet the Queen. And she, from the moment she came here, she started buying things that the Queen liked. Like, you know, she went to Harrods and she bought gloves from the Queen's glove maker and, you know, little bits and pieces like this. And she desperately wanted to meet her. Her dream was to go to Buckingham Palace and, you know, have tea with the Queen, which would have been amazing. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. But she had a press person who used to have a list of things that she wanted him to do. And one of the things was, you know, meet the Queen. And Laurence Olivier would sort of, you know, poo-poo it and, you know, just take it off the list every day. He didn't think that she was worthy, really, of meeting the Queen. However, the Queen's representatives knew that there was going to be this Royal Command performance coming up, and they thought that Marilyn would be ideal to meet the Queen. And it may not have been, you know, tea at Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle, but it was going to be a huge event. There was lots of celebrities there, and it was a film premiere where all of the celebrities were lined up and Marilyn was one of them. And the Queen came down the line and she shook everybody's hand. And then when she got to Marilyn, they had a little conversation because the Queen said to Marilyn, "Oh, I hear that we're neighbours." And Marilyn was a bit confused. And she says, "Well, I live in Surrey." And the Queen says, "But I just live next door in Windsor." And so they had a little bit of a discussion about that and about riding her bicycle in the park and things like that. And then the Queen moved on and Princess Margaret then spoke to Marilyn as well. And she spoke about Marilyn's husband, Arthur Miller, was doing a play at the time. And Marilyn asked her if she would go along and see the play. And the funny thing was, I wrote to her in the 1990s and said, "You know, do you remember if you did go and see the play?" And she had actually did go because Marilyn had asked her to. So it was a huge night. And then afterwards, Marilyn was quite happy to speak to the press that night about what she thought of the Queen. And she thought she was a very sweet person who radiated sweetness, she said. And she showed them how she did her curtsy and all that kind of thing. So that was a huge, big deal for Marilyn. And actually, she said that was the highlight, that and Arthur Miller's play were the highlights of actually being in England. She didn't mention working on the film as being a highlight. She just thought those two things were the best things she'd done.
Wow. And so was Olivier jealous that he wasn't, or did he get to meet her too? Or,
well, I mean, Olivier was, you know, friend of the royals, and I think that's one of the reasons why he didn't want Marilyn to meet her, because, you know, he thought that, I mean, I'm just, you know, yeah, presuming that, you know, he was the one who had friends in royalty. And I'm not sure what his reaction was after Marilyn had met the Queen, but I can't imagine that he was very impressed by the whole thing. I mean, by that time, they had almost finished making the film anyway, so he was sort of distancing himself from the whole debacle anyway. So I can't imagine that it made any kind of, you know, effect on his day at all. Other than the fact that Marilyn was late that day, the next day coming back.
was it just her behavior at work and maybe the way she acted that Olivier didn't like, or was there something more going on here?
Well, he wrote in his autobiography that he had a feeling that he was going to fall in love with Marilyn. So possibly he was a bit disappointed by the fact that didn't happen at all. But it was the way that she was always late on the set, or when she came onto the set and they'd be all in full costume and something would happen, he would say something that she didn't disagree with and she would just walk off and she'd be gone for a couple of hours. And sometimes somebody would have to go to the dressing room and just, you know, beg her to come back. So it was quite a challenge to work with her. I mean, so many people have said that it was a challenge to work for Marilyn or with Marilyn. And he just wanted everything to go to plan the way it had when they did it in the theatre, because they'd done that play in the theatre and everything was fine. He just wanted, you know, a quick make this film and get out of here. But it didn't happen that way.
Did that film do well or no?
Well, it had mixed reactions, really. I mean, I absolutely love it because, you know, I'm a Marilyn fan and I'm British and it's a British film and all this sort of stuff. But it did have mixed reactions, although so many critics, actually, this is a funny thing. The critics sort of said that Marilyn was one of the best things in it. And Laurence Olivier was very stilted and, you know, and they didn't really understand his character or what he was doing. But Marilyn, you know, she did receive quite good reviews for it. So in that way, it was a success.
Did the Queen ever talk about Marilyn?
Well, the Queen famously doesn't talk about anybody.
Right.
So we don't know. But I know that she had seen Marilyn's films because a couple of years before she met Marilyn, they went to another film premiere and Jane Russell was there. And the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen spoke to her and they actually mentioned Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So they had seen that and they talked about that for a little while. And then shortly after the meeting, there was an article in the newspaper that said that the Queen, as a result of meeting Marilyn, the Queen had watched a lot of Marilyn's other films. And this was a funny thing because she was also quoted by a friend, you know, in inverted commas, as saying that she felt sorry for Marilyn because she had licked all of her lipstick off out of nerves on the night that she met her. And if you look at the old footage, there is Marilyn licking all her lipstick off. So that's quite an interesting observation. But yeah, famously, she doesn't actually say anything. I mean, I wrote to her in the 90s and said, you know, would you like to tell me about how, you know, what it was like to meet Marilyn? And no, I didn't get an exclusive interview with the Queen, unfortunately.
Well, you know, she mustn't have got the letter.
Yeah.
I mean, how could she not, you know?
Exactly.
So the whole thing is just pretty amazing. So when someone picks up this book, takes it home, is there something you hope that they take away from the book other than the actual, you know, story of just, you know, the Queen meeting Marilyn and that? Was there something more?
I hope that when people read the book, they'll see Marilyn as a human being, because so many times, you know, she's seen as this person on the screen, this dumb blonde or whatever on the screen, and or just a pinup on somebody's wall. But she was a real life human being. And I think that the book shows that she was a, you know, a living, breathing person with faults and with wonderful personality as well. And so I just hope that they see how hard she worked. And it wasn't an easy trip. It wasn't easy to be over here with, you know, surrounded by strangers from, you know, who all appeared to know each other. It was a hard trip for her. So I hope that they do come away seeing Marilyn as a human being, just like you all.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
That would be a lovely thing if people saw that of her.
Why do you think that people had that impression? Is it just the way Hollywood presented her and the way she was shown in magazines and things? Like what? Because like, and I say that because there's a plenty of, you know, other actresses, and even during the time that became famous, that were also good looking and had more of a reputation of different than her, you know what I mean? Consider it to be more smart, I guess that's the word.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's the million-dollar question. I think that it hasn't helped from when Marilyn passed away until now, that, you know, the strange articles that have popped up over the years saying that she's one thing or another. And it's just, you know, I think everybody has a different idea of why that happened. It's peculiar to me because, you know, you don't look at any other actor, like you don't look at Johnny Depp and think that he's really a pirate, or you don't look at Arnie and think that he's really a robot. You know, it's incredible to me, but that people look at Marilyn and go, oh yes, she's a dumb blonde. That is very strange. I think it probably says more about them than it does about Marilyn, in all honesty.
Yeah. It's just strange how that's, and it's held on for years. It's not like, you know, what was your favorite thing to learn during researching this book or writing it?
I loved hearing about how Marilyn was with the residents of Englefield Green, which was where she lived. It was so lovely to hear about, you know, she used to come to the gates and talk to the people and what she used to speak to them about and what she, you know, all the different things that they spoke to her about. And that was lovely because that showed her in a very down to earth, you know, sort of normal way. I loved that. I also loved finding out about how different people chose to use Marilyn's name and Marilyn's image to further their own cause. You know, for instance, like, you know, beauty queens, if they looked like Marilyn but didn't win the beauty contest, they'd complain and say, well, people don't like Marilyn Monroe types. Why don't they like Marilyn Monroe types? You know, they were using her name constantly in the press to sort of further their own feelings about different things. And she was discussed in Houses of Parliament and, you know, different councils up and down the country. There was councillors who wanted her to be on road signs, you know, just silly things like that, that never happened. But there was all these different layers of different things that people wanted Marilyn to do while she was over here. And that was really, always really fun to find out, because it was something very different, I thought. And some of the stories were very funny. And I think it as well, it gives a nice look at, you know, what 1950s Britain was like, which, you know, I'm always very nostalgic for that. So, yeah, that was lovely.
Well, having written so many books about Marilyn, why do you think people have such an insatiable appetite to learn more about her?
I think that it's because she's many different things to many different people. You know, some people love the fact that she spoke out against Hollywood or the men of Hollywood. They love that she studied acting. Some people just love the image of her on the screen or on their walls in posters, all these different things. So I think that she's, I mean, it's such a deep question because she's just so many things to so many different people. And I think that's what keeps her memory going, because we all have a particular type of, you know, Marilyn that we like, and a different era that we like to read about or find out about. I mean, you know, I love all of her life, but there are things that I've always loved, you know, like the England trip or whatever. And when she was in New York, So yeah, I think she's just many different things to many different people, and I love that.
So the place she was staying at, was it the place the press thought it was, with taking pictures of the bed and all that, or where did she stay?
No, it wasn't that house. This was the funny thing. That house actually belonged to a very eccentric lady called Mrs. Coates Preedy. And she was this lady who thought that she was going to become Marilyn's best friend because her house had been rented for Marilyn. And she said that she'd kept this scrapbook, and it was, you know, just all about all the different things that was in the press and all the things that they were going to do. And it was just quite funny, actually, how she thought that she was going to become this, you know, hugely popular person in Marilyn's life. And she spoke to the press all the time. And of course, that's why Marilyn never stayed there, because she completely, you know, just told everybody where she was going to stay. So they just let her ramble on about Marilyn becoming her best friend. She even went on the television about it. And they quietly rented a house called Parkside House, which was in Surrey. And so she went to stay there, but nobody found out about that until the actual day that she was here. And the press, you know, were sort of adamant that they would know, they would find out where she was going. And then, of course, they followed her car and they did find out where she was, much to the horror of Mrs. Coates Preedy, who was left with Marilyn's entourage instead of actually hosting Marilyn and going to parties with her, which is what she thought was going to happen.
Well, and so you mentioned too that, like, did she like living in that apartment? Like, did she like living down in Surrey, or how was that?
Well, she expected that it was going to be like a little English cottage. And I think, you know, with flowers around the door and the little thatched roof and everything. And of course, when she got there, it was a mansion. It belonged to a lord who wanted to show them all around and everything. So I think she was quite shocked by how big the house was. And it came with a whole host of servants, and not just servants in the house, but servants in the garden. You know, there was the gardener, there was a lady there who, you know, who cared for the chickens and the herbs and things like that, the vegetable garden and all that kind of thing. So she was never seen to be on her own in that house. There was always people like looking and, you know, listening and seeing what was going on. So I think it was quite a shock. So in terms of actually living there, I think she was probably quite glad to leave, but she did have some happy times there. You know, like I said, when the fans used to come to the gate, she would spend a lot of time speaking to them, because that to her they were just, you know, the normal person off the street who she could identify with, because she saw herself that way too. And yeah, and it was sort of an escape from all the different prying eyes of all over Parkside House.
Oh, I bet. And so you mentioned that about it, the house, about servants and people like that giving stories to the press.
Yes, there were certain stories that sort of popped up that were actually things that she had said or things that she had done, and people started to wonder what was going on. And it did turn out that a couple of the servants had sold stories and they were fired. So that didn't go down very well, and Arthur Miller actually wrote about that in his autobiography. And I think the official line at the time was that they were fired because they didn't cook the right kind of food or something. It was something really strange. And that was what made the headlines. But actually, it was because they, you know, they had been speaking to the press. And then after that, of course, every time the press came near the house, everybody sort of backed off because they didn't want to be the ones, you know, being kicked down the drive after the last lot.
Well, you know what her thoughts were on the press? I think that, you know, the media is kind of a double-edged sword for any celebrity.
Yeah, I think that she, when it was on her terms, she really liked them. Like when she did the press conferences and everything, the press were wrapped around her little finger. She loved it. And, you know, she really brought everyone together in the room, and she was just wonderful in it. But when they started to sit outside her door, she didn't like that. I mean, she wanted the public side of being available to the press, but then she wanted her, you know, human being private side, which I can absolutely understand. And she did not like them hanging off the wind, you know, off the roof, looking through her bedroom window, for instance. I think she could have done without that.
Oh, geez, that's just the beginning of the fun. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. And so this whole trip, when she went back to America, how do you think this UK trip changed her? Did you notice something different in her behaviors after she went back to the US?
I think that she did want more privacy. And certainly the next year, 1957, she didn't work at all. Her and Arthur Miller sort of divided their time between living in New York and Connecticut and Long Island. And she just, she said when she was leaving England that from now on, what she wanted to be was a wife. She wanted to concentrate on being, you know, Mrs. Arthur Miller and living this, you know, so-called normal life. So I think it did show her a little bit about, you know, what she was missing, because she came over here as a newlywed. They had literally just been married a couple of weeks. So to get that start over here of everybody just into her business as soon as she came over here with a new husband was quite a surprise to her. So I think that she did go back home thinking that she wanted to recover from the making of the film and just be quiet for a while, which she was for a good year and a half before she went into making Some Like It Hot, which, you know, that wasn't, they didn't start shooting that until mid-1958. So she did have a very long block of time off, which she hadn't really done before.
Well, what was Arthur Miller, her husband's opinion or his kind of overall attitude toward the UK and how Marilyn, you know, how it treated her, for instance? Like, what was his thoughts?
I think he really loved the UK. He did a play over here. He was very comfortable here. And in fact, one of the government departments actually asked him if he was, you know, actually planning on leaving, because he seemed to be too comfortable over here. And they were a bit worried that his passport would run out and he'd still be here. But I think that he was surprised by what it was like to be with Marilyn as a working actress, because he hadn't really seen that side before. When they were going out with each other, she had been making Bus Stop, but he hadn't been with her all that time when she was making it. But now here he was asked to be going onto the set, you know, some days. He was asked to, you know, be on her side instead of Olivier's, when it's sometimes he actually felt a little bit sorry for Olivier. So I think it was a bit of a confused time for him, but certainly he really did enjoy being over here himself. By his own admission, he thought it was a lovely place, and he visited again many times.
Yeah, that's funny, you know. So he didn't really fight with Olivier, or he wasn't mad at him for being mean to her.
No, and that caused a little bit of chaos too, because he felt like he couldn't speak to Marilyn about, you know, the way that she was on the set and things like that. And he did feel more compassion towards Olivier at times. And so he ended up writing his thoughts on a notebook. And somehow, we don't quite know how, but somehow Marilyn was able to see it. The official story is that it was on one of his desks, and she came to look for a pen or her script or something, and she came across it. And it said something about how he was disappointed in her. And she took it very, very badly. And that caused chaos on the set too, because she had a bit of, you know, a breakdown, so she was off work for a while, and it was a very, very horrible time. And I know many, many people who say, oh, he should never have done that, that was the beginning of the end, that was a terrible thing to do. And it was a terrible thing that she found it, but I had to approach this when writing the book, I had to approach it in the way of a writer and to think of myself in a way, because, you know, we do write things down. Writers are, you know, we write stuff down that we can't speak about. And you know, I have to say, in the early years of my marriage, if my husband had read my diary, we'd have had the same situation, you know, because it's just one of those things. So I sort of came at it by, you know, at that angle. And I completely understand that he had to write down his feelings. Why he didn't hide it, I don't really understand that. I don't know how that happened, but it's a terrible thing that she found it, and it's a terrible thing that you know, that she thought those words were his official words on how he felt, when actually it probably was just a spur of the moment. You know, he probably thought it, wrote it down, got on with his life, and then of course she found it, which was a terrible mistake of his to make.
Well, maybe he wanted her to find it.
Well, yes. Well, that's the thing. We just don't know. And he never really spoke about it. So
no,
we just, you know, we just have our imaginations.
We just have to guess, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm with the press. Let me change this. No. Well, it's pretty amazing. So so the book comes out in the week. It comes out on the 2nd. That's fantastic.
Thanks.
What have you got planned next? Are you going to continue to write more about Marilyn? Have you got more stories to come up with?
I'd love to write more about Marilyn. I mean, you know, she's my happy place. I just love her. And, you know, whenever a publisher comes to me and says, oh, we've got a good idea for another Marilyn book, if it's a great idea and, you know, I want to hear about it, for sure, definitely. I would never, ever say that I would never write about Marilyn again, because I just love it so much. But I'm, you know, I've also written about many other people. So I like to write about whoever I can. And I've also written several novels. So I'm going to write another novel hopefully this year. So yeah, I like to keep busy, but at the heart of everything I do is Marilyn. And if anyone ever wants me to write a good book about Marilyn, then, you know, I would have to have a pretty good reason why I wouldn't want to do it.
Well, there you have it, you know. And do you have a website, or do you have social media that you like to interact with fans and readers?
I do. I have Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at mmwritergirl. And on Facebook, you can find me at the official Michelle Morgan author page. But I'm mainly busier on Instagram. That's my place that I like to be.
Yeah. And a website, do you have that as well?
I don't have a website. I just have social media at the moment.
It's going out of fashion, isn't it?
It is. I used to have a website, but then I found that I wasn't updating it, you know, at all. And so I just thought, well, I don't know. I sort of left it as an experiment to see if I did need it. And it turns out I don't think I do need it. I think as long as you've got social media where people can contact you, then I think that, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's it too. It's about the contact. It's about them being able to sort of get a hold of you, you know.
And that. Yeah.
I also noticed, like, see, now you've written about Madonna. Now that's quite... that's quite the challenge, considering how protective she is and that she's still alive.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge Madonna fan, have been since I was about 14. And that book actually is a photographic book of, I think there's like about 250 photographs. And then I wrote about 200 or 300 words about that photograph or about that particular time in Madonna's life. So it was a tribute to Madonna. And I actually say it in the introduction as well, that it's like, you know, it's a tribute. And I have no intention of writing like a big biography about her, because I know that she doesn't like that kind of thing anyway. And I would never want to upset Madonna.
No.
So
she'd come after you. Look out.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'll tell you.
So I would rather just have the book that I worked on, which was a lovely photographic book. And I really did enjoy doing that. But that's my only Madonna book that I've got then. I don't plan to do any more. Certainly no salacious biographies.
Oh, come on. Just think of the fun you'd have. Well, anybody else that you're sort of fascinated with is in stars that you'd like to write about?
A good question. I mean, I really love Princess Diana. I think it would be a lovely thing to write a book about Princess Diana. And Betty Davis. I was born on Betty Davis's birthday, and I always think of her as, you know, my birthday buddy and an inspiration. So that would be lovely to write a big biography about Betty Davis. But I don't have any plans to write those. But, you know, it's always nice to keep them in my list.
How was I know that you were interviewed for the CNN, Reframed Marilyn Monroe, I believe it was called. How do you like doing those sorts of shows?
Well, I really loved doing that. And normally I'm approached quite a few times to do interviews for documentaries. And most of the time I have to say I turn them down because it seems to me that as soon as I mention that I don't like to speak about any silly conspiracy theories or anything like that, they're like, oh, okay. So I don't like to do anything like that. But CNN, when they came to me, it was actually the production company Raw who made it. They came to me and they were so convincing that they wanted to present Marilyn in, you know, this human way, and that my contribution wouldn't be anything, you know, about conspiracy theories or anything like that. And I really liked the fact that it was women who were making it. And yeah, so I spent a day with them in 2020. I think it was September 2020. It was like probably one of the first times I'd been out of the house in you know, 2020. Yeah. So that was nice. I spent all day with them being interviewed for it. And it was just a lovely experience. And I'm glad I did it. I haven't actually watched it because it hasn't been on in the UK yet. So I haven't seen it. I've no idea really how much of my interview got on the screen, but it was a happy day. It was a happy thing for me to do.
Oh yeah, it's quite good. It's very good. And you did very well. You talked about Marilyn being a lizard woman and and all sorts of things. It was, yeah, they changed all the words.
Oh, great.
No,
and
I know.
You even have to have your head powdered like Al.
Yeah. Yeah, my last show. They're starting to powder my forehead. Well, they, you know, it's an interesting thing, you know, and it's a good thing like that. You know, how was COVID for you and writing and doing your work?
I mean, for me, it was okay because, you know, I work from home anyway. The thing that was quite an adventure was suddenly my daughter was at home from school. You know, obviously, I'm used to her going out every morning. My husband was home working from home. So that was interesting because I'm used to complete silence for the whole day. And then all of a sudden, the TV was on and the radio was on and, you know, this, that, and the other. And so that was a bit of a challenge. But once I got into the swing of it, it was nice having them home. But yeah, the whole thing was I still can't even believe that we went through all that. To be honest, it was a very strange time to be alive.
It certainly has been. I think the whole last 5 years or so has been kind of strange.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of what we go through. You know, in the Hollywood time of Marilyn, Marilyn was probably one of the biggest stars in the 60s. Wasn't she one of the highest paid back then?
Well, Marilyn's pay, I mean, Marilyn's pay would I would be quite happy to be on, yeah, Marilyn's pay, what she was on then. But she was never really hugely well paid in comparison to some of the others. I mean, I wrote a book about Carol Lombard and she was the highest paid actress for a while. I can't remember how much she was paid, but it was something really, really huge. And Marilyn always said that she was never really into it for the money, although, you know, obviously she wanted to be paid fairly. She was more into it for the good roles and having director approval and all that kind of thing. So no, she wasn't one of the hugely paid actresses at all. Although, as I say, it would be nice to be on her money right now.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, even little money in Hollywood in those days. Was she the person that was always wanting to be an actress right from a kid?
Well, she grew up not really wanting to be an actress, or she said she didn't really think about being an actress, but she did play out all the different scenes that she would see in the cinema. If she went to see a film, she would then play out all these different scenes, but she didn't sort of see that it was actually acting. She just sort of saw it as playing. And then when she was 16, she was sort of married off to the man next door, the boy next door. And during the war, somebody came to the factory where she worked and took a picture of her, and that's how she became a model. But at that point, she was just concentrating on modeling. She wasn't concentrating on acting at all. And it wasn't until a year or so later that somebody, you know, sort of said to her about acting, and she started to think about it a little bit more. And then all of a sudden, you know, she didn't want to be modeling so much anymore, that she did want to actually be an actress. But I think that she was a, it was like me when I was saying earlier about how I grew up not realizing that I was a writer, but I actually was. Mm. I think it was the same with her, that she was, you know, playing all these different parts, acting out all these different roles, not realizing that she was actually acting. She was just playing as far as she was concerned. So yeah, I think that she was destined to become an actress one way or the other.
Well, she's been very influential. What do you think her legacy is?
Well, I think that, I mean, that depends on who you speak to. I hope that her legacy is of this brave, strong human being who wasn't scared to stand up for herself, wasn't scared to speak out about the things that were going on in Hollywood. You know, she spoke out about the wolves, as she called them, you know, different producers who tried different things with her, and she spoke out about them, and she walked away from her Hollywood career to start her own film company because she didn't like the roles that she was getting. You know, all sorts of different things like that. She was such a strong person, and I really hope that she eventually is remembered for being so strong and one of the bravest women in Hollywood, certainly in my opinion. That's what I would like.
Well, it's always an interesting conversation about stars like Marilyn and from people that know all about it. So we really appreciate you being here. We're going to have your social media and your book up on our website so people listening can do one click and find you and find your books. So,
oh, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Again, we've been talking with the great Marilyn Monroe writer, Michelle Morgan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really lovely.
Thanks, Michelle.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.